Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Gillian Hastings Ward. Gillian is the chair of the Genomics England participant panel. She's part of the Genomics England Access Review Committee, is a founding board member of the Cure Grin Foundation, and is one of the participant reps on the National Genomics Board. And as, or more importantly than all of that, she is mum to Sam, who has the very rare genetic disorder GRIN1, and that was diagnosed by the 100,000 Genomes Project. Gillian, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Chris.
We have lots to talk about today around research and clinical activity and how patients and participants can be involved in shaping and improving all of that activity. But I'd love to start with a bit about your background. No one is born as the chair of the Genomics England Participant Panel or the patient rep on the National Genomics Board. How did you first get interested in representation? I think I'm right in saying you started life as a chartered town planner. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I did. It's not exactly been a regular career trajectory, but I'm very pleased to be where I am now. And it's certainly been a great use of the skills I've picked up along the way. My first degree was in geography. And then as a geographer, you need to decide what to do next. So it was teaching or town planning were the two main options for me. So town planning it was. And I did a master's in town planning at Cardiff University. And for my dissertation there, I got interested in expressions of national identity when we were looking at the construction of the Scottish Parliament building and the Welsh Assembly building, which were just being designed and built at the time, and thinking about the extent to which disabled access had been built into those and what that might say about the idea of nationhood, really, and how inclusive it really was.
I was a student in Edinburgh at the time of that, and the Scottish one suddenly was hugely controversial about things like how much it cost and how long it was taking and so on. What did you establish about this national identity and buildings piece?
Well, certainly the disability community were quite horrified at the Welsh design, because you had to go up quite a lot of steps to be able to then look in and look down on the debating chamber. And that difference in level was something which I'd never even considered before. As someone who's never needed to worry about levels before, I was quite struck by that. And it got me talking to a number of disability consultants who'd been working on the various projects, and I found it very interesting. And it was just a whole side of life that I'd never really considered before as someone who didn't have any disability in my own family. So that was very interesting, and it has led on to an interest in how we express the built environment and what that means about how we value different people using it. So had a nearly 10 years in private consultancy with ARUP, and then moved into the civil service, the department responsible for the planning system in England, where I was until Sam was born.
Ah, and ARUP, a sort of legendary engineering consultancy firm like Sydney Opera House and things like that, right?
Yes.
What kind of projects were you involved with at ARUP?
Well, mostly it was research to underpin policy documents. So I did some work in Wales looking at where we might put more renewable energy into Wales. And I remember a great meeting going along with one of my colleagues to speak to the Minister for Planning. And we had a whole set of acetate overlays where we were basically doing a sieve mapping exercise about what different techniques and technologies might be appropriate in different parts of Wales and how much you might be able to generate off the back of those. So really very different from patient representation altogether.
And so you went from that to working directly in government?
Yes, that's right. The department at what's now known as the Ministry for Housing and Communities and Local Government, MHCLG, was plain old CLG in those days. While I was there, I was working on development management policy. So the decisions that get made about individual properties, which obviously is enormously contentious. If your neighbour is planning to do something that you really object to, what are your scope to do anything about it? And so got first-hand experience there of hearing from people who are being directly impacted by decisions that they can't do anything about themselves, because they've either been set by national policy or decisions that have been made by their local government planning officials.
So are you responsible for the bat corridors? I've had a couple of friends who've been renovating houses and have had to build in kind of, is it bat corridors? Is that the right phrase? Sort of space for bats to roost.
Not directly, no. But that's an example of how many things the planning system tries to encompass these days. And it is very complicated, yes. But one of the big ideas which stuck with me after my planning degree was something which has come up again more recently, which is a paper which was actually written in 1969, so a very long time ago in planning terms, by a lady called Sherry Arnstein, and it's called The Ladder of Citizen Participation. And it appeared in the Journal of American Town Planning Association in 1969. And what she was talking about was the extent to which communities who are affected by neighbourhood development proposals can have any influence over what those actually do in the world. And her ladder of citizen participation was a way of conceptualising that. And actually, it's quite a useful model that we can bring into healthcare as through the genomics to think about how people who are affected by the healthcare system are able to feed back into that system to make it work better for everybody.
Fantastic. And tell us about the ladder. What's at the bottom and what's at the top?
That's a good question. Yeah, so if you imagine a ladder with eight rungs on it, at the very bottom we have basically being told that something is about to happen. So it's basically the PR end of engagement, where you're just saying, right, this is going to happen in your neighbourhood or in your health system, depending what we're talking about. And so that's deemed to be really non-participation. It's broadcasting news rather than actually engaging with people about it.
Yeah, we're gonna knock down your house because we're building a superhighway, so please move.
Yes, that kind of thing. Or we are thinking about changing the way we deliver our health service, and this is how and this is when it'll affect you. So then we can move up the ladder into what Arnstein describes as degrees of tokenism, which sounds terrible, but actually is a step towards the right direction. So we've got informing people, we've got consulting with people, where you're actually listening to what they've said to you. And then we move up to what she describes as placation, which is where you then tell somebody what you're going to think about doing as a result of what they've told you, but you still don't give them any power to make any decisions in there. But beyond that, things get really interesting. So rung number six is about partnership, which begins to talk about negotiating and making trade-offs between the people who've got the power and the people who would be seen to be the powerless in any scenario. And then we get up to delegated power, where the group of users, as it was, begin to have some role in actually making decisions about what happens to them. And then the very top rung is citizen control, which she describes as full managerial power over the development process. Now, there's obviously lots of different levels are appropriate in different contexts. And certainly in the healthcare setting, I don't think anybody's advocating for a full managerial power over how their health services are supplied. You know, you want to be having somebody else, the experts need to be in charge. But within that, there still has to be scope for conversation about who's really benefiting from what's happening. And that is something which I think is really interesting.
It was interesting. I say interesting. The first bit of the story is painful rather than interesting. I fell off my bike in January and broke my hand, which was the painful bit. But then the interesting bit was then after it had been patched up in A&E, going into an appointment in the hospital to talk about surgery or a more permanent cast or what the options were. And it was a sort of borderline case and the x-ray versus the hand mobility, whatever. And I had a couple of sessions and each time they were like, well, it's borderline. And in the old days, we would have just said, well, we're gonna do this to you because we're the patriarchal doctors and we know best. But you know, what do you think we should do? And I definitely felt like I was on a rung too high of the ladder. I was like, I have no idea. I'm not a hand surgeon. Please, can you be more patriarchal and just tell me what to do? I guess there's something about what's the how do we find the right rung of the ladder for the right circumstance or whatever.
Absolutely. And from the participant representation side, how do we climb the ladder? How do we demonstrate that we are partners which would be worth working with from the view of those who are in the power? And also, whose ladder is it anyway? How does this whole thing start?
Absolutely. You're clearly now playing a very empowered role in the part of the health system that we're thinking about here around genomics and so on. How did you first get involved in this world of healthcare?
When Sam was born, he seemed to be a regular kid, but as time went by, he was missing all his developmental milestones, and it became quite clear that he was actually quite severely disabled. But all the tests that were available through the NHS at the time came back with no result or nothing diagnostic. So we were invited to join the 100,000 Genomes Project in 2015. And in the spring of 2016, the invitation came out to through the network of regional genomic centres to any participants in the project who were interested in joining in with what was going to become the participant panel, where Genomics England were offering a platform for parents and carers and patients to come in and tell them how it felt to be participating in the project and to help shape decisions that were made about the data that you guys were holding about us. And that seemed to speak really well into the sorts of skills I've built up during all these years in consultancy and in the civil service. And also, at the time, I was just seeking some way of making sense of my world, because I'd had to give up work with Sam arriving. And when you're used to having been a professional and then you're at home with a small person all day, it's quite a challenge.
It must have been an extraordinarily difficult time in a whole range of different ways. We talk about patient empowerment. It's really interesting that it sounds like there's also an element of kind of personal empowerment here.
I think that's true. And when you're, you know, in any circumstance that you weren't expecting to be thrown into, I think there is an element of, bewilderment initially. And then as you begin to get used to your new circumstances, you start thinking, well, what can I do about this? How can I build on what I've got in my toolkit to try and dig myself out of a hole or to make the best of a situation which I would perhaps never have wished for? And, you know, while I love him dearly, it's a very different life from the one I was expecting. And so if I can use the skills and talents and experience that I've got to make the world better for him and people like him, then I'd be a fool to try and do anything else, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And people talk about reorienting when, as you say, you have this mental image of what the life that you're going to lead is going to be. And then like, whoo, okay. It's incredibly impressive. I mean, you've talked about the lack of a diagnosis through a whole series of consultations with different doctors and so on, which people sometimes talk about as the diagnostic odyssey, something that is all too familiar to families with rare diseases. Obviously, every family will have a different experience. What's your view on how that affects these different communities, different families?
Well, I think, as you've said, it does vary quite a lot between different families, and it depends a lot on what your life was like before the event happened as well. Some people are still trying to raise disabled children and work full time, and that's a huge pressure on them. Others are in a more fortunate position, perhaps, where they're able to work part time or share responsibility with their partner or whoever. And I think there are certainly common elements to rare disease diagnostic odysseys, which we can speak to. And I think one of the good things about the participant panel is that we bring a lot of different perspectives in. You know, we're coming from different life experiences and different conditions. But the common points are very much that you're all keen to find out why this has happened and to do what you can to make the journey that you've had an easier one for anyone who comes along in your footsteps, as it were. Other people who've spoken on your pod previously have talked about how important it is to learn lessons from journeys that we've been on to make sure that those journeys are less painful for others.
Those diagnoses and helping move those families and those communities forward, it's obviously incredibly difficult work to solve the science problems, to think about then how to translate a solved science problem into an actual set of clinical activities that will make a difference to a family and so on. Rare diseases and ultra rare conditions, each individually, as the name suggests, are incredibly rare, although collectively, as we know, lots of people suffer from rare and ultra rare conditions. You've done a lot of work on trying to bring those real world experiences of those families into effectively the kind of the workflow of those scientists, those clinicians, doctors, and so on. How can we use those connections to make this work better, and to make sure that the work is actually making a difference to the lives of families who are living through these different situations, these different circumstances?
Yeah, I think the first thing that's so important is to get the different parties into the same conversations about what matters to them. And one of the things that's been really exciting that we've been working on at the Cure Grin Foundation recently has been having meetings where we're talking to the scientists who are the world experts in grin disorders. Some of them are working in labs where they're using brain organoids. Some of them are working with mice. Some of them are clinicians who are working with children with grin disorders. But we're talking to them about what is technically, scientifically possible over the coming decade or so, and trying to match that up with what it is that families themselves would really value moving forward. So for us, it's all about trying to improve the quality of life of our children, basically, even if we're not looking necessarily at a cure in the very near term. There are things which it would be great if we can address some of the symptoms. And so we're trying to explore the common ground there and to find out with the scientists what we can best choose to invest in that's going to bring benefit to all of us as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's so important, isn't it? Because are we solving the right problem? It's just such a obvious but such a fundamental question, whether it's designing a technology project, working on a scientific cure, whatever it is. And it's obviously a specific set of situation, but I guess just to bring it to life in the context of GRIN, what kind of things would make a difference?
Well, a lot of us have children with quite serious epilepsy, and that means that they're having seizures quite frequently, and that in itself has a massive impact on your cognitive abilities and your ability to learn things and build on what you've learned in the past. So if we can find a way of addressing that, I think for a lot of us that would be a really great step in the right direction. Others are concerned about muscle tone, for example. Quite a lot of children in our community have low muscle tone, and it does affect things like their digestive systems and may also affect their breathing. And in fact, we've lost a number of children in our community over the past few years, and a lot of that has been due to respiratory issues. So if we can find a way of addressing that side of the condition as well, that would be phenomenal.
And in the conversations with researchers, how have those conversations played out, and what's happening as a result of them?
Well, there's going to be a science plan we're going to be publishing later in the summer. We're going to be discussing with the community again in June once we've drafted what we're thinking at the moment. But the intention is to identify a small number of key targets for investing the funds that we've been able to raise so far and that we're planning to raise in the future, in order to help fund the research that needs to happen in order to find out what kind of treatments would be effective and safe to try on our children.
And going back to our ladder of participation, where do you feel that in those conversations the GRIN community of families with members who have GRIN and the GRIN researchers, are you going up and down the ladder? Like, where are you at, and where are other groups of researchers and patient groups?
I think Cure Grin is quite a good example of being fairly high up the ladder, to be honest. I mean, we're our entire operating model is that we are a patient-led research organisation. We're trying to drive this forward. And so we're squarely in the partnership bracket, I would say. You know, we can have very balanced conversations with the researchers and say, well, you know, the science does sound very exciting. You know, genetics and gene therapies can really offer such potential to our children. But what does that mean in practice? You know, how does that reflect on our lived experience, and which aspects of my life can you make better and when? And that's a really eye-opening thing for them perhaps as well, because obviously they're spending a lot of time in labs thinking about the science and the technical stuff behind this. And it's great to be there to be able to remind everybody that this is essentially about finding solutions for patients, rather than it just being a scientific problem that needs to be solved. Although I have enormous respect for the technical skills and the expertise that we have on our scientific advisory board as well. They're just phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, and you're also casually dropping terms like brain organoids into the conversation, which demonstrates how much you, as so many people who either themselves or in their family have one of these conditions, how expert people become so quickly. I think, as you say, Cure Grin is a great example of a very empowered community, a very productive partnership with the researchers who are working on that. For folks who are listening who might be in a context where they feel that they or their community are much lower down the ladder, so to speak, what kind of things, just pragmatically, can people do? Like, who should they email? What should they do? You know, how did you get to where you are now with Cure Grin?
Okay. So the first thing is you have to find each other as a community. And social media has been phenomenal for that, because it's much easier now than it was even 10 years ago to find other people who've got the same condition around the world in most cases. I've got other friends in other rare disease communities within Britain, and they're saying, oh yeah, our Facebook group has 4 people now, we're so pleased, you know. And you know, you have to start with these acorns, because otherwise you're never going to get to your oak trees. So that's definitely the first step. You have to find each other, and then you have to be able to mobilize around a common goal. You have to agree what matters to all of you together. And then you have to be able to reach out into the science world and be able to make contact with the people who have the skills and the expertise out there to be able to start having these conversations with you. And that's something which I would very much be keen to encourage within Genomics England's remit as well, that we can make it easier for people who are affected by different conditions to actually get to speak to people who have the expertise and the labs who are already researching, in some cases, some of these things behind the lab doors, as it were.
That's great. And it's a very inspiring example. And it must have been quite a journey for you, going from, as you say, those kind of acorns of first participation to the stage now where the 100,000 Genomes Project has recruited and sequenced and in many, but obviously not all cases, kind of diagnosed or fed back results to the participants. The success of that program has now given us the ability to support the NHS in launching the Genomic Medicine Service for both rare disease and cancer, which is kind of in live clinical testing at the moment. That must have been quite a journey. And how did that feel? And, you know, where does this go next?
For us as a family, it's been a wonderful thing to be part of the 100,000 Genomes Project. We are very acutely aware that we're among the 25% of participants who've had a positive result so far. But we're confident that the whole purpose behind this, the sort of altruistic aim that was set up from the beginning to find answers for humankind as a whole, rather than specifically for us as patients, that hopefully as time goes by and more people use the data that you guys are holding about us, we'll get more answers for more people. And that's got to be a great thing.
Absolutely. And there's a really interesting combination of positive human characteristics here, right? Because you mentioned altruism, which I think is hugely at the part in this. I think there's an interesting thing here about reciprocity as well, that different communities can help each other both across different disease areas, but also there's an interesting, I don't want to get overly cosmic, but there's an interesting kind of present day to future generations mix of kind of, solidarity almost with future generations, that this generation of participants is making things that much easier, that much better for kind of subsequent generations of people with these kind of conditions.
Certainly, I would love to come back on that, because I think in some ways you're absolutely right that, you know, the more we understand about what makes up a genome and what each different bit of it does, the better we will be able to categorise what's causing people's health conditions and hopefully find ways of addressing those. But we have to be very careful about suggesting that we will, once we get to a perfect understanding of the genome, that will not also have societal and ethical implications, because we need to be sure that the way that we're using genomics is going to benefit the people whose data is being used and going to benefit patients. We're not in the game of saying, oh, you know, 20 years from now, we'll have mapped the whole genome and then we can use it to tweak anybody that needs tweaking in order to make them into the aspirational perfect human, because that's really not where we're going. And I know that some people are still concerned about that as a possibility. So for me, what I would like to see is genomics being used to address health problems rather than taking us into the realms of what's currently science fiction in adjusting people into a way which society says they should be adjusted.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's a topic which I think is only going to grow in relevance in the debate in the coming years, right? With CRISPR-Cas9 and gene editing and, you know, the twins that were born in China already moving, I think, from the realm of science fiction into an actual real tangible problem that we need to develop a perspective on, right? It's interesting though, because you, and I don't think there are any easy answers here, but I'm going to ask you a really difficult question and just see what your thoughts are. You've framed this as we should be focusing on solving health problems and not on trying to create the perfect human being. there's probably a spectrum there, right? From sickle cell anemia, single change in the genome means that you either do or don't have sickle cell anemia. It's a really serious condition. It's a health problem. The sickle cell community is working with researchers really hard on a cure. I don't think that there's anyone who would say, no, we shouldn't cure sickle cell anemia, we should just do this. Through to conditions that, for example, are screened for prenatally, like Down syndrome. And I know there are lots of people who would certainly not frame Down syndrome as a problem to be solved. And people with Down can have really joyful and wonderful lives. The deaf community is very articulate and kind of passionate on deafness is different, it's not worse. How on earth, as a society or as a group of different communities with different views on this, how on earth can we navigate these choppy waters in the next kind of 10, 20 years?
Absolutely. Well, it is a big question, and you're right. But I think, you know, it's about having conversations with the public, and it's about showing examples of people and situations where what some people might consider to be a disability, others consider to be an attribute, or certainly something which they're content to live with. And, you know, it's very difficult, because some of the debate here is about, you know, what does society think is the ideal? And I think if you look to anybody, any of us have spelling mistakes in our genomes, which diverge from what counts as normal. And who are we to say that somebody else's variations are suboptimal? You know, it might be just fine for them, and we can't presume to know what other people think is important. But I think there is a merit in having wider societal debates about where the red lines should be, particularly if we're thinking about what is and is not an okay use of the genomic information that we're collecting at the moment. And I know there's a lot of work been going on in that space, but I think then all it takes is a headline or a story from Coronation Street where a family choose to not proceed with a pregnancy because they've had bad news due to prenatal screening, that it just takes us back 20 years. And you just think it would be wonderful if we can see a more nuanced and a more realistic presentation of disability in the mainstream media.
It's I have size 13 feet, which is a real pain when I'm buying shoes, but I don't think that genetic engineering is probably the right answer to that. I think if I could persuade someone to make shoes in a decent size, that would probably be a lot easier scientifically and practically.
There we are, and that is a perfect example of the social model of disability. You have very large feet. Society doesn't make the shoes that you need necessarily in all the styles that you would wish. But if you could persuade more shoemakers to do that for you, then you wouldn't need to worry about large feet anymore.
Exactly. And it's interesting, actually, going back to almost where we started with wheelchair access to the Welsh Assembly. You mentioned this point about people not really thinking about these things until they enter their life in one way or another. And I broke my leg quite badly a few years ago and was in a wheelchair for about 6 weeks, and oh my god, immediately on day one and for that entire time, you just see the world in a completely different way, and you can't then unsee that. How do you think as a society we can get people who are not directly involved in these topics, who aren't either themselves sick or who don't themselves have a sick kid, who aren't doing, you know, postdoctoral degrees in bioethics, you know, or whatever they're doing. How can we have that conversation on a broader scale than these sort of niche communities who are very deeply involved in it?
Well, it's a very large question, and you know, I wouldn't pretend to be an expert in public communications and you know, herd psychology or whatever. But I think the more that people can encounter examples of people who are different from them, the more we can all learn about each other. And that has only benefit, I would say. I think mainstream media is definitely part of that. But I think these days everyone's on social media too, and having good examples that come through from advocates who are personally affected, if we can express our experiences in ways which resonate with people who've never come across this before, then we can start to tell stories which then linger in other people's minds. And it might hopefully make them think twice about what they see in the street or other stories they hear in the future.
Absolutely. And as we look forward, I mean, we've talked about the 100,000 Genomes Project, which of course is ongoing on the research and findings front. The Genomic Medicine Service, which is in terms of whole genome sequencing, is just in the process of launching at the moment. These technologies and approaches are coming into the mainstream, which is hugely exciting for, I think, all of us, in both in the patient and participant community, in the healthcare community, in the technology community, the science community, and so on. What should we be thinking about over the next 5 years as these things come into the mainstream? And how can we kind of keep ourselves oriented towards these true norths about doing this right?
So I think we all need to understand the main drivers behind our motivations for each of these different parts of the communities that we need to bring together: patients, clinicians, researchers, and technologists. We all have to understand what our motivating factors are and what motivates the other partners in that conversation. So dialogue is absolutely critical, because if you don't ever get to speak to somebody, how can you guess what they're thinking, and how can you establish what matters to them and help find the common ground with what matters to you?
It's such a good point. And I was hearing at secondhand a conversation recently about between a patient group and a couple of researchers, where they were talking about exactly this point about motivation. And the patient group said, not in an aggressive way, but just in a straightforward way to the researchers, well, presumably one of your motivations is also to get a good science paper out of this, right? That you want to get that into Nature or Science or Cell or whatever. And the researchers were like really shifty. And they're like, well, we'll publish, of course, but it's about the impact. It's not about the paper. And the representatives were like, it's okay for that. Like, that's fine. That's your job. That's your career. That's how you advance in your career. Like, that's fine. We can all just be straightforward about it. We don't have to pretend that people don't have other motivations other than sort of pure sainthood and kind of, you know. But it's about how do we reconcile those, and how do we turn those into a constructive partnership where as much of each group's agenda is being served as possible, right?
Absolutely. And in that example, then of course the patient group can say to the researchers, well, you know, we can help you do exceptional research here if we help to shape the questions that you're answering to have demonstrable benefit for us. And you can help us even more than we thought you could if you listen to what our experiences are. And we can tap into your expertise, you know, obviously, people are reapplying techniques which they've tried somewhere on something else all the time, and so that, you know, that's how we learn and grow, isn't it? So, you know, we need expert researchers, but we also need that dialogue with patient groups.
For sure. And on the subject of dialogue, as you know, we're doing this podcast series as part of an aspiration around a national conversation on genomics. We've talked about a lot of topics like transforming healthcare, social issues, science and research. What are either some topics or some people that you think we should pick up on as we go through the series?
I would love to unpack some of the issues around primary medicine, so GPs, and what they think about genomics. Is it basically just bringing them a shed load of people with questions about, well, why hasn't my genome been sequenced yet? Or are there things which actually could help them in their practice? And so, yeah, certainly primary care is something which I think is as yet underexplored in this regard. And that's inevitable, because it has to start with the specialists. Of course it did. But most people's experience of the healthcare system is still going to the GP and having conversations about relatively common things. And as genomics is gaining the ability to move into that sort of sphere, I think it would be very interesting to discuss some more with the primary care community about where they see it helping and what we can do to support them in doing it well.
That's brilliant. And in the meantime, Gillian, thank you so much for making the time today and for everything that you're doing, both for Genomics England, the 100,000 Genomes Programme, the Genomic Medicine Service, the National Genomics Board, and more broadly with Kiagrin and the research participant conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a great chat.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.